Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva.
Does it?
It digs
a little deeper.
Oh, yeah. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, with the deep voice.
That was like a WWF commercial from the
90s. That's more like he was trying to try out for the Kool-Aid Man.
Or the truck. Did everybody skip over the monster truck rally announcement guy?
Sunday.
I mean, it's all basically saying the same thing here.
You know what?
Although the Kool-Aid Man is the creepiest option by far. Thank you, Spencer.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chad Riley, Spencer Williams.
Howdy.
What's up?
Hello.
I like that shirt. Stop it.
Nobody can see the shirt, okay?
It's an audio podcast.
That's why I said I like his shirt. We actually have a show in store for you. We actually have a great show in store for you, as we are going to be talking about a released film that is in theaters right now that is actually getting a lot of attention, and that is A Quiet Place. So stick around as we jump into that. But before we do...
You said A Quiet Place, so I shushed you.
Well, why don't you give information? Give a little bit of information.
Quite frankly, I kind of do. The avant-garde experimental side of me wants to do the entire episode in whisper, but we're not going to because that would be stupid. Though not produced by Michael Bay, thank goodness, the Filmlosophers podcast is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. I say that because this movie was produced by Michael Bay, among others. You can listen for the latest and greatest movie reviews by subscribing to the Filmlosophers podcast on any or all of your favorite platforms. New episodes debut each Wednesday on Spotify, Audioboom, iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Stitcher, and Player FM.
If we were ever forced to stay silent for our own safety, you'd still be able to catch up on movie news and other updates on social media. Type quietly. Be sure to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Finally, don't think you have to limit yourself to just this episode. You can access our entire library of great content on our website at filmlosophers.com.
There you go. Well, we have a great show in store for you, as we're going to be talking about the film that people are actually giving time and effort into watching, because
as opposed to other movies that they walk out of.
No, I'm going to be frank. This was done by John Krasinski, and if anything, it probably wasn't going to get taken as seriously, because I don't see him as somebody who can do horror. Like, just being frank, and I'm not going to lie and say, you know what, he's probably great writer or whatever. I don't know. It was one of those kind of up in the air kind of things, but it is actually getting a lot of good attention, and so yeah, we're going to talk about it. That is A Quiet Place. Chad, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Set in a post-apocalyptic world, a family of four must navigate their lives in silence.
There he goes again.
After mysterious creatures that hunt by sound threaten their survival. If they hear you, they hunt you.
That was pretty creepy.
Yeah, good.
Just following your lead.
Directed and starring John Krasinski. The film also stars Emily Blunt, Noah Jupe, and Millicent Simmons. This marks John Krasinski's third time in the director's chair for a major motion picture. Note that I said major motion picture. I know last week we kind of had a little bit of a disagreement in terms of the statement of not being specific.
So I believe the term you're looking for is feature-length film. So we're still hunting for that vocabulary use.
His second...
Thank you for playing.
His second was 2016's The Holler, and his first being 2009's Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. Actress Millicent Simmons has been deaf actually since infancy due to a medication overdose. This is the second film she starred in, with Wonderstruck back in 2017 being her first. And another...
Which is exciting. I did not know that the actress... is deaf in real life.
Oh, yeah. Mm, who, yeah. Was it you who had mentioned it in the theaters?
No, that was Marcus Allen.
Okay, yeah. Mark. Well, one of the guys in the theater happened to mention that the younger little girl was actually deaf. And it's pretty remarkable. I honestly thought there was going to be like a little bit of like a carrying aspect where, you know, just for the sake of inclusion, having somebody play that role. But she did phenomenal, which we'll get into in a little bit. Also, one little tidbit of information. Paramount Pictures originally intended this film to incorporate it into the studio's Cloverfield film franchise. Ultimately, and thank God, the studio decided to allow them to make the film as a wholly original and standalone film.
Yeah, not every film needs to be part of the Cloververse now. It's just, like, for some reason, rapidly expanded.
Although, honestly, in retrospect, I was looking at this and I thought, okay, well, in terms of creature design, I actually could see that. Because creature design of these predatory figures actually does have a lot of resemblance to the city-sized monster in Cloverfield.
Yeah.
I mean, not entirely, because they don't have eyes, for example. But, like, the way that they move and the prominent, you know, muscular forearm things and the almost scaliness and whatnot, like, just there's a lot about it that does harken back toward that type of creature design.
True. As I said, this is a horror film, although many people could actually debate that it is not really horror. There was, and I say that just because there was a couple of disagreements that we were hearing while in the theater at the screening, where some people were like, well, I don't really think it's horror. It's more like, you know, suspense thriller. It's more just like thriller. There was just a lot of debate. And I mean, I could see that because it's not meant to scare
you. It's a much more well-rounded movie than I expected going in. I mean, it is... Yeah, it's got a horror component. It's got a suspense thriller component. It also has a really strong like family drama angle that is well done. So it's a richer movie than I expected it to be.
Yeah. One of the things that I want to note, and of course I've said this over and over, I really like horror movies. So it's almost like pulling teeth when I try to present a horror movie to this table.
Especially me.
Especially
I'll take the brunt of that because it's me.
But it's not because I like horror movies for just the reasons why, you know, and growing up or whatever, but I don't really know the reasons as to what made Spence, because I know why Chad doesn't like horror movies, but I don't really know why you're not a big fan either.
Oh, it's because most of the time it's predictable and people doing things that people
so I have heard
do.
It. Okay, never mind. It's the same thing.
It's basically the same.
Yeah, basically the same thing.
The same idea.
Well, thankfully, this film didn't really do all those things. But being a big fan of horror, one of the big things that I had coming into this movie, honestly, was, and I'm going to be as truthful as possible, I didn't think it was going to succeed. I'm just going to be honest with you guys. I don't know John Krasinski for being a phenomenal director. He's done a lot of independent pieces. He's now incorporating his wife into this one, which in my mind, I was thinking that was probably the bait piece for a lot of big studios to really put the money behind it to promote it.
Well, and allegedly, she fought to be in the movie. Like, they were originally going to go with somebody else, and she basically, like, pulled the trump card as his wife and said, no, I'm doing this with you. It was an interview that I saw on YouTube, of all places, with the two of them. So she advocated for herself to be in this role,
well,
which worked out tremendously.
She's
a lot of the reason that you should go see this movie.
But like I said, that's
even if you don't like the genre.
Oh yeah, true. Yeah,
or the supposed genre, I guess you could say.
That's honestly going into it. That was literally probably the only thing I had on my mind is that this is a film that is going to be directed by John Krasinski. I'm not too familiar with John Krasinski's work. But if this movie is anything like The Office, it's not going to be that good. So that's pretty much all.
I mean,
he
was also in 13 Hours. He's also starring in the new Jack Ryan series on Amazon or Netflix, anyone? One of the streaming services. I mean, he's done things aside from comedy.
True, true. And then, like we've stated earlier, he has directed other films, those two other films. But I don't know. I know. This is not really saying much to you guys, but I hold horror in a very unique place in terms of genres, because it's easy to come to a place where you can find a predictable or ridiculous or overly troped, you know, type of horror film and be like, yeah, that was stupid, that was horrendous, that was bad, that was everything, which tends to be more than most. But when it comes to John Krasinski, I don't know what really fills that foundation to make me believe he was going to do a good job. Plain and simple. What about you, Spence? What were some of your expectations before going into the movie?
Well, first off, I didn't know John Krasinski was even directing this till the credits rolled. So I was very surprised about that. This is going to sound kind of weird, but the reason why I was kind of excited to see this movie was actually because the trailer really reminded me of an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There was an episode called Hush where they had to stay silent for, it was about 30 minutes of the 44-minute runtime of the show, and it was actually really fantastic. It was the only episode, I think, to be nominated for a daytime Emmy. So that kind of spoke well of the concept. So just because I saw the concept, I was like, well, that should be pretty interesting if it's done well. And I thought it was.
You're right, because, I mean, the idea of, you know, don't speak or you'll die kind of thing. That whole premise, storyline, plot device, however, it's been used before. But the biggest thing about it is that it has to be used well, obviously, yes, with that as a great example from Joss Whedon. But, you know, like I said, it goes back to just my whole, you know, hesitancy was that. What about you, Chad?
Yeah, I think that as much as I'm very resistant to the genre as a whole, I tend to not find it as entertaining as others among our esteemed
table. No, you don't.
Table.
I remember taking you to go see It. That was a great experience.
At least, I gave It some kudos after seeing it. That was after too many uses of the word It, because that's the name of the movie and just a placeholder term. But after seeing the movie, I gave it some credit. You can go listen to that episode if you want to. There were some things I still didn't like about it because it needs to lean into the genre from which it was birthed. And I'm not a fan of the genre overall. But this film, I think agreeing, Spencer, with you, there were definitely some signals in the trailers that were released in the months leading up to the film that I thought actually made it look compelling. I wasn't super excited about the idea of going to see it in the theater. A Quiet Place, not It, but A Quiet Place.
We're talking about A Quiet Place.
Now I'm back on the movie we're talking about this time. But, you know, so I wasn't super stoked to see it, but to see A Quiet Place. But there were some things I thought might be compelling, especially the, like, don't make too much noise angle. Like, are they going to go full silent? Are they going to have some atmospheric ambient noise? Or, you know, like, obviously you'll have moments where somebody makes a mistake, like, you know, in the trailer, you saw the kid knock over the lantern and start part of the floor on fire.
Yeah.
And the dad has to go over and put it out with a blanket really fast. And so you know that there are going to be punctuation marks, you know, where there's noise and you see what does or doesn't happen as a result of that. But yeah, there were some things within the trailer. And especially, I think the thing that really compelled me that signaled to me that this was not going to be like similar gore fest creature feature horror movies is that you didn't see very many people in the trailers. You saw a family of like four.
Yeah.
And usually with a typical gore fest creature feature, you've got 15 or more characters because
you gotta have expendable
they
people.
Have to die. Like they have to die in front of you. And the trailer,
there's
didn't
only so
show.
Many ways you can chop up Emily Blunt. I'm
yeah,
just
I
saying.
Mean, the trailer only showed the family. And so I thought, well, maybe this will be different because there don't appear to be that many characters, which means you're not just constantly watching people die in potentially mildly inventive ways.
Yeah, and that was I think that was another little thing in terms of this is the trailer was interesting because you mentioned the trailer. The trailer was interesting. The trailer did bring a unique vibe and feel to the overall film of what was going to be presented later on, but with, you know, everybody total silence and everybody playing with playing Monopoly like by rolling stuff on a carpet and they're using like paper or fabric little tokens.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I can honestly say this literally, you know, threw me for a loop after the film was over in terms of expectations, because I really did come in with not that great of mindsets. And I'm glad you guys had a little bit more of a optimistic perspective on this one. But yeah, let's just jump
right in. Well, it makes total sense. I mean, you're a fan of the genre. We tend to not be.
Yeah.
So for you as a genre fan going in with low expectations and us as not really fans of the genre thinking, oh, this one might actually be serviceable. I mean, in a way, we were kind of, expectation-wise, we were kind of meeting in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when it started, so.
Good point.
That's rare. For horror movies, you and I especially are usually not on the same page. I'm a giant baby. I'm a full-grown baby about it. Like, why am I here? Can I leave? Can you tell me what happened later?
It's true.
I mean, pretty much. It's a caricature, but it's an accurate one.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and dive right in, shall we? So obviously, right from the get-go, I mean, literally as soon as the film begins,
First of all, this is a spoiler-free review, so we're not going to give away too much because it would be giving away too much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't enjoy it if we gave away too much.
So you'll still enjoy the film if you listen to this first and then go and see the movie. So jumping right in, you are immediately introduced to the family, which includes the father, played by John Krasinski, the mother, Emily Blunt, and the children. Now, I'm using these very vague terms because I never, ever saw or heard anywhere their actual names.
Nope.
No, so, there was only two places in the movie where a name was mentioned.
Yep.
That was one shot of their house where it had their last name on it, Abbott. And then you saw a photo of a baby, and it had their name, if you could make that out, and the time it was on screen.
Huh. Well, either way, they were just a family. So they're obviously, they're looking for things. It's already established that the world has already gone to poop.
Yeah, it's what, day 79 or something like that in the beginning?
Yeah, when we start off.
That's the very first thing you see. So you're thrown into the middle of the story.
Mm-hmm. And so you're immediately introduced to a world where sound is not a good friend. It's not something good at all to have. They're looking for items, they're looking for stuff, but, to survive, food, medicine, things like that. But this was a great introduction to your main characters. You're pretty much your sole cast because you don't really see anybody else in the entire film.
Not really, no.
But you recognize Emily Blunt. She plays the mother, obviously, the kids. I just want to highlight the fact that Millicent Simmons, she played a really good character. She played a really good role in this film. So
she's the oldest child. She's their daughter, who is deaf.
Yes. And surprisingly, knowing the fact that she was deaf before we saw the film, as the film begins, there's a lot that's riding on her character in terms of the entire storyline.
A ton.
And going back to my first, hesitant, mindset, that kind of scared me. Not for the fact that, she could or couldn't act. That wasn't the case at all. But for knowing whether or not if she was going to be able to bring the whole film together. Because, like I said, a lot of the storyline is going to be leaned on her and her disability.
Well, I mean, I don't know. She definitely, you can tell that she's, I think, that opening sequence, number one, mm-hmm. I mentioned this briefly after the film, but if you remember what it was like to go through a whole range of emotion at the beginning of the Pixar film Up, because an entire micro story that's told at the beginning in the first, 5 minutes or 6 minutes or whatever. Yeah, the opening 5 or so minutes of this film is like a fully contained micro story of its own that sets the stage for then you do a time jump to roughly a year later.
Right.
Beyond what you see in the very, very beginning. And you go through a lot of emotions in this first 5 minute period because you're becoming aware to a certain degree of what has or hasn't happened. There's no primer that says, in March of 2017, the whatever happened and then these creatures. Like, there's none of that. You occasionally have glimpses of a set of newspaper clippings that the father has kept and he's researching, like, where do we think these creatures came from? Mm-hmm. What do they want? Once they figure out, oh, it's sound. They hunt by sound. There are just various different newspaper headlines that if you're fast enough to read them, because they go by fairly quick, then you can piece together some of the backstory that nobody ever tells you in this film. Like, you either pick up on it or you are just in the moment. You are holding your breath. You are having little micro bursts of adrenaline in your system, and you don't know anything.
And I have to admit, I thought it was really, really great as to how the introduction of some of these newspaper clippings, it seemed very much like talking about last week's episode. I believe it was last week's episode where we talked about a Pacific Rim Uprising.
Yeah.
Right.
That vibe of a 50s film, but a 50s like horror film where you had like Doom, you know, in this newspaper that was just hiding, or that was in the window, or, you know, Army can't stop this. It's happening. It's alive. And as soon as the film was over, I was like, I was telling Spencer, I really enjoyed that piece because it really gave a lot more a foundation to what this film is giving homage to, which, all in all, it's a creature feature. This is what this film is at its heart.
That's what it presents itself as. Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And you can see where it's trying to build a lot of that foundation for that aspect of where it sits in horror.
Mm-hmm. There is a lot of homage in this film.
Oh, yeah.
Like a ton of homage in this film. So I really appreciated that. I mean, there were different sequences. I thought of, you know, Steven Spielberg to bring up another, you know, recent, just some guy we've talked about before, you know, with Ready Player One. But there was some Jurassic Park. There was some Jaws. There was, you know, Ridley Scott. There was some Alien kind of vibe in there. Definitely other kind sort of creature feature things, you know, like the Blob, or, you know, like just old school kind of feel. It feels very contemporary as a film, but there are a number of shots and sequences that were, I think, pretty blatantly harkening back toward other things sort of in the same wheelhouse, and I really appreciated that.
Going back to the performers, though, it's a really interesting thing. You could have the best cast who can speak very eloquently, and you can have a great, you know, just ensemble of performers, but it takes a unique breed of people altogether to be able to translate a lot of your emotions and a lot of the subtle nuance of a film and the emotions they're in with just looks and the eyes and, you know, the physical posture and the way they go about, you know, just using their body to act. And the fact is that this film is like 75% no dialogue. Either there's sign language or it's just physical, visual cues. And you would think that's kind of one of those things, like a make or break type of thing for most people. Like, oh man, I got to bring my, some people, I got to bring my reading glasses and, you know, to whatever. But I think this film does a really incredible job with its performers in terms of it allowing them to really shine and kind of put on a great performance physically to translate a lot of what the film is trying to say. Because you have instances where you can't, you know, they can't say anything. So it's with a look that the mother gives to the son, you know, recognizing the fear that he has, or the father looking at the daughter, you know, trying to get her to understand what he's trying to say. There's a lot of that going on in this film, and even the most like highest moments and most the peak, I guess, the climax of certain points, those are even done with visual cues, and it's done really well.
Yeah, it's a very compelling presentation. I think you definitely kind of hit it on the head with saying it takes a certain type of performer to do it well. And your standard, I mean, not to downplay the performing acumen of your typical horror film stars, but your standard horror movie person does not need to have a lot of nuance, texture, depth, to their characterization and the way that they embody a character. They don't need it because, number one, they're on the screen for like 10 minutes and then they're gone or less. Or if it's one of the primary performers, they're just in that kind of adrenaline fear, fight or flight response the whole time. And there doesn't need to be a lot of, again, nuance, texture, and depth to their performance. They're just always on the go, trying to outrun the evil force, whatever that is. In this movie, you need a lot of texture, depth, and nuance because, yes, the threat is real, and at different times it comes around. But most of the time, there's this tremendous, very rich, story of a family that's trying to survive, and all of the tension and interpersonal, complexity mm-hmm. of family situations, and how do you translate that when you've got young kids? I mean, the daughter is the oldest, and she's 11, 12, 13, somewhere in that range.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm thinking, like, as a kid, I would want to scream. I would want to throw something. I would want to make noise, and I can't do that. And even the child actors in this film did a great job mm-hmm. showing that, like, there's no release. There's no full release of all of the tension of this unfair situation and how it's changed their family dynamic. And they can't go back to what they were used to when they were young before all this started. And I think that there's a lot that's in there. There's a huge well of subtext in the performances of John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, mm-hmm. As the mother and father. Obviously they're married in real life, so they have a good amount of trust between them, hopefully, as spouses. But, just what they have to communicate either in the same scene with each other or completely separate in different scenes, but that almost like gravity tension between them is still there about how they have to almost silently try to make their family work and as healthy as possible, given their circumstances. I thought the performing caliber of this cast was fantastic.
What's weird is I really felt like I was a mind reader during this movie because just all the looks, like the looks between John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, I felt like I knew what they were saying to each other while they were saying nothing. Yeah. And I'm not married. I don't know what that kind of relationship's like, but it's weird to just be able to like get what people are like sending thoughts to each other. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Even though there's not like a whole lot of sign language in this movie or reading in it, like you can just pick up on what everyone's thinking mm-hmm. and feeling like 90% of the time.
Yeah.
And
agreed.
That's kind of the mark of like a really great physical performing cast. I mean, if you had somebody who was unable to do things like that, it would be an extremely just off-putting movie because you would have no idea what one person is trying to say the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm trying to think who do you consider not a very physical actor or not a very physical performer?
Is that a question for the class?
That is a question for the class. Because, like, in my mind, like, Kevin Costner. So, Kevin Costner used to not be a very physical performer. He couldn't really... every scene he had to do, he had to say something. He had to just pretty much say exactly what he was feeling or whatnot because he couldn't physically act it out. And I think if, like, somebody like Kevin Costner was put in the role of, like, John Krasinski or Emily Blunt, we're in 2018, who knows? But, put them...
It's an interesting proposition.
Hey, Kevin Costner in a wig.
I mean, no, considering that like one of the important parts of Emily Blunt's character is that she's with child. I don't think that's a huge spoiler to say. Like, in a world where you have to remain silent, she in the time jump, a year into the future, she's like ready to pop. And I mean, we've all seen pregnancy scenes in TV shows and movies before. There's a lot of deep breathing and screaming and whatever, and then there's the squalling of a baby. Like there, I remember the first glimpse you caught after the time jump, the first glimpse you caught of her in the distance, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, is she pregnant? And it takes about 2 minutes for them to confirm visually that she's pregnant, and you're just sitting there the whole time thinking, oh no, that is the ticking time bomb.
I was just gonna say.
Of like, your MacGyver Mission Impossible kind of situation. They use physical countdown clocks. Yeah, that pregnant woman is the ticking clock.
It's the slow moving guillotine, if you will.
Yeah, because you're just like, oh, that's not gonna go well.
No.
There's just no way she can't stay quiet. The baby can't stay quiet. What are they gonna do?
And I think one of the big reasons why we kind of are pressing so much in terms of Emily Blunt's performance is because that woman steals this
film. She owned this movie.
Completely owned this film.
Which says nothing against the other performers.
No, not at all. Which is why I stated earlier, you know, the entire cast did phenomenal. But if there was anybody who really went above and beyond in terms of those, you know, physical performances and really acting out emotions as opposed to just speaking towards them, this woman soared up high above all of them.
Yeah.
Easily. But that goes to, you know, the director's focus and his vision in terms of how you choose. Like, what goes into your thoughts in terms of deciding whether or not to have your film be, you know, a talkie, I guess, if we're going to use those types of terms.
A talkie?
I mean, or a silent film. I mean, the majority of this, like we said, of this film is done either through sign language or no, you know, body language, whatever, but no dialogue. So how do you try to make that work? Like, where does that come from? Like, where does any ideas? I don't know.
Like, where does the idea for this movie come from? Because it was, I mean, that's clearly a unique situation to
it
this.
Is.
Whether
yeah.
or not to have characters talk, which I think it should be mentioned, there is a scene where there's full voice talking going on, and that was a really welcome scene. Like, as an audience member,
yeah.
I mean, I'm the kind of person who tends to try to live in the world that you're building for me when I'm watching a movie. I was routinely holding my breath, like clenching, you know, my hands or my feet, like to not make too much like rustling noise in my seat, as if I was there in the environment with them. And so when you have a scene about, I don't know, halfway to two-thirds through the movie, there's a scene where there's a bigger noise than the noise that they would make, and two of the characters talk for a brief moment using their actual voices. They talk, and it was such a welcome release, even as an audience member, to say, "Oh wow, I don't know how you've done it for a year and a half or however long it's been, but I would not be okay being that quiet for that long. There would have to be some sort of outlet."
Yeah,
because we have most people, you know, have voices and can hear and do use them, and you know, so anyway, it was nice. But in terms of the, you know, when do you decide to make it a silent film versus a talkie? this definitely is not a silent film. It's not.
No.
It's not devoid of sound.
Yeah,
the Foley artists had a lot of work to do. They actually shine pretty well because that's the only sound you hear most of the time is the Foley artist. They're the ones who make the sound effects, the natural, you know, the brushing of leaves or the rustling of cloth or footsteps on the floor, whatever that might be. Even, you know, the motion of hands as they're doing their sign language. There's a little bit of sort of whisper talking happening in some of the sign language scenes, which was also kind of nice to see that they don't, you know, they do form words even while they're, you know, using sign language. But
yeah,
I think it was really interesting though, whenever you are with the daughter who is deaf, the sound cuts out pretty much entirely most of the scenes where you're just with her experiencing from her point of view. So you even notice the difference between full silent and just really, really quiet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which you recognize early on. It's going to be a part of the main overall plot device of when they recognize her perspective as opposed to everybody else's perspective. Even it's almost like you are a participant in the family, in the environment they're in. So this is what you normally hear when you're with everyone else. But the moment you're taking on her perspective, it's complete silence. It's just really interesting. And maybe it goes to what Spence was talking about in terms of like Joss Whedon's episode. I'm pretty sure, like we said, this isn't something brand new to the cinematic world.
Right.
But it is a plot device that has to be done really, really well, or else it's no good. There was a 1950s episode of Twilight Zone. Actually, it was in the 60s because it was around when they started doing really crappy work. But there was an episode of the Twilight Zone where they do this thing where they make a bet with this guy where if he could, you know, be quiet for an entire year, that they would give him like $100,000 or whatever. At the time, that was a lot of money. and ultimately at the end they're like, oh, we can't pay you, but you know, hey, good try. And they realize, you know, he slit his neck to cut his vocal cords. But like I said, that's not a great really premise for the show. It didn't really pay off that well. I didn't really like the guy who, you know, hurt himself, so I didn't care that he hurt himself.
Well, but that was so Twilight Zone, right?
I mean,
Twilight Zone always has the twist.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I cut myself for you. No.
Wow, that went to a weird place really fast.
Don't hate.
As we say in the business, that took a turn.
No, but it's like I said, the director's choice to use this style for the film was very unique. And honestly, because we've spoken already to it a lot, but I think it really does pay off. It does really well for this particular film in terms of it being a plot device. It's not the main, you know, storyline. Like, you're not, as much as the trailer makes it seem, silence is not like the only thing that everybody is focused on. There's obviously, like I said, you know, the mother being pregnant, the daughter being deaf, and, you know, the father worrying about her growing up in this world, you know, the son, the husband being the protector of everything, and still having, like, regular, real-life, like, family issues and drama, all in the midst of this post-apocalyptic world. It's kind of like, and I don't know if either of you watch The Walking Dead, but or read The Walking Dead, but the actual zombies or walkers in the comic have actually begun to play a backstory to the real craziness and chaos that is going on between the people who are still alive. So the zombies are just this constant threat in the background, but the main focus of the story is now just entirely on the viciousness of man and how people will, you know, step over their own mother just to get, you know, a loaf of bread and peace or whatever. So I think it kind of really does well to that in terms of it being one of the devices for the overall story, but not the main.
One of the things that really stuck out to me in this movie was not only, I think one of the big prominent things is the parent-child relationship. You've got different ways of relating between the parents and the mm-hmm. children, respectively. But the other thing that really struck me while watching it was, and I know that there's a bit of stereotyping that, you know, we all can tend to do, but the way that a mother would react to a situation and the way that a father would react to a situation, the kind of the way that biochemically we're wired, you know, as men and women, I thought that was really, really like front, like out in front
mm-hmm.
in a lot of the scenes where you saw how the mother related differently to the children than the father did. But there was total support between the two of them for the way that each of them was parenting the kids without being able to, you know, talk and argue and all those things that parents, mm-hmm. you know, do in the real world. They had this understanding between them, but I thought that the portrayal of the strengths of those two different approaches, I thought it was really compelling. I'm a big fan of human psychology. Just in terms of studying, like watching people and how they behave and how they react to each other and how we present those kinds of premises in film and television and all of that. That's very, very intriguing to me. And I thought without the ability to speak vocally in this film, mm-hmm. again, with that subtext, you like the man's struggle is like almost universal in terms of like, I could see myself struggling in that way, except mm-hmm. I wouldn't know half the stuff that he knows, like how to make the upgrades for, you know, his daughter's, you know, ear implant kind of stuff, hoping yeah. that something's going to work, or setting, you know, animal traps, you know, in the wilderness and all that. Mm-hmm. Like, I got some learning to do.
Chad's not ready
to be that kind of, you know, husband and father, but
Chad's no survivalist. Let's just be honest.
I like to be comfortable. No, but like there was a lot that I could relate to in yeah. his internal struggle and how that was or wasn't shown to his wife or was or wasn't shown to his kids. Mm-hmm. And I think equally so on her part, the kinds of things that she was very concerned with, their holistic health and well-being, the children specifically, and making sure that they felt affectionate touches and glances and glimpses and things like that, where the father was a little more, you know, trying to shape them to survive, to to like give them the tools to survive beyond their parents' ability to protect them or not. And, you know, there's something very universal. Not, again, it's a bit of a stereotype. It's not 100% universal that everybody's dad acts like that, everybody's mom acts like that or anything.
Yeah.
But in terms of the relatability of them as almost archetypal figures, I thought I was very pleasantly surprised by how sort of face forward that subtext was in the story versus dwelling so long on staying quiet and not getting eaten or whatever, you know, that it was a lot more about these more common themes of human life, you know, kind of like you're mentioning with the whole Walking Dead reference. You know, it's really not a story about the creatures. The creatures are a catalyst to get us to focus on a deeper, broader, and richer story altogether, which in this case is the family.
And it's great to see, you know, kind of what you were saying, towards what you were saying, it's great to see that it wasn't just a group of people. Like, I think in the scope of how most groups are created or structured, when you have like survival type situations within post-apocalyptic situations like this, or however, there's always more of a me type of mindset. It's the individual that you're more focused on. It's not really how it's connected with the group, but more of how that person is willing to do whatever it takes to survive and so forth. Whereas in this aspect, every single person within the dynamic of this, you know, this family mattered a great deal in terms of survival. So it wasn't just, you know, the dad focusing on his way of how he's going to survive, but he was also focusing on how it meant for his family and so forth. And so it changes the dynamic of how you see the group itself, and secondly, how you see the film as a whole. Because then it's no longer just because then it becomes like a Saw movie. In a Saw movie, you just have, you know, people who are thrust into a situation, and it's like dog eat dog. Everybody tries their own way to survive. Ultimately, one ends up, or somebody ends up, everybody ends up dying. Anyway, but the bottom line
is it's a much simpler story. for all the complexity of like ways to die and number of characters, it's a much simpler story than this one.
I agree, but this film has a lot more heart to it, I guess, if you will. And it's difficult to really say something like that for a horror film. You don't really put those two hand in hand and like, oh yeah, this is a horror movie and it had a lot of heart.
Yeah.
You know, it's very...
And because of the mechanics of, you know, you're not supposed to make noise, I think it heightens the audience experience too. Like you are more intensely focused on everything watching this movie than your typical movie. And I think that when you get to those emotional payoffs between the characters, or even, you know, a standalone payoff, you know, with one character, you feel it more because you're so focused on how quiet all of them need to be.
Yeah.
And you, if you feel like you're in the movie like I do.
I know we've spent a lot of time on the family, but I kind of want to put a little spotlight on the design of the creature. Now, I've seen a lot of creatures in my day. Well, just saying. And I have to say, this one was pretty interesting because obviously, like we stated, this isn't a spoiler to anybody. The creature is, I guess, provoked by sound. So if it hears a sound, if it hears any type of frequency making anything, it picks up on it and it comes and attacks it instantly. Whether if it's a, you know, an electronic or a, you know, somebody speaking or yelling or whatever, it'll find it, it'll go directly to it, and it'll attack it. So you would pretty much have to understand that this monster has a very large, like, auditory type, you know, set up for his ear, for his head, not his ears, like ears wise. It has to really find, you know, you have to have a way where it's, you know, receiving a lot of that audio signal or audio frequency and so forth. So when you actually see the creature, the way it opens up its head, or it opens up its auditory listening area in the head, mm-hmm. I'm like making these weird signals to my head.
Again, audio podcast.
You know what, Spence? I really like the design of it. I really like the design of the way this creature looked. It wasn't overly like grotesque. You weren't looking at something that was, you know, looked like it was a, you know, a creature from the, you know, third planet from the stars or whatever. It didn't look anything ridiculous. It looked menacing, and I liked the mechanics of how it existed ultimately, because of the fact of how it listens, how it chooses to hear any, you know, any noise being made.
I mean, you think about it. We have eyes that can see things, and sometimes the sun is bright, so you wear sunglasses, or you have eyelids and eyelashes in the first place, right? Mm. To help manage the amount of light that might or might not be damaging to your eyes. In a very similar sense, the creature design accounted for the fact that, you know, if essentially they're all ears and teeth on their head and they have no eyes, then there would be some risk in the design if that, you know, intense hearing ability was unguarded. So as they're moving around, generally speaking, you know, the deep, deep ear well is sealed off, you know, but when they're kind of intensely hunting, their head kind of opens up and you see the ear open like a giant cavern. And that makes a lot of sense just in terms of creature design. It makes sense that if that's the way that they operate and live, then mm-hmm. there would be stages of openness for that. So I thought mm-hmm. that was, you know, intelligently designed. I wasn't a huge fan of the sort of similar to when we were talking about last week, with Pacific Rim Uprising, at one point, the Jaeger, the robot, goes into outer space and then plummets back down to Earth to hit the big mega creature. And the human pilots are fully exposed during reentry, but don't burn up. Like, that really, like, you showed me the robot on fire and you showed me the broken windshield, let's say, but they don't burn up. That doesn't make any sense. In this film, I had a really similar problem with these creatures. It was my only problem with the film, really, was the, if you sit and think about, this is a creature that hunts by sound. Mm-hmm. Why can it not hear heartbeats? Why can it not hear frequencies until it's close? Because it doesn't actually, like, hunt by frequency. There are lights that are on. There are television monitors that are on. There are all kinds of things that, even though I can't hear it with my human ear, I know, like, you know, dogs can hear frequencies humans can't hear. If this creature was bred, or, I don't know, just became, you know, and hunts by sound, it's going to have a much, much broader, wider, more robust set of sounds that it even can hear and hunt by. So there, it's a little bit of a cheat for me, I think, in terms of the overall creature design. But in terms of, you know, not making it impossible for the humans to survive, you know, I guess there are some things where I think the logic of the creature falls apart, not necessarily the filmmaker's fault. They couldn't completely stack the deck in the creature's favor. But yeah, there are definitely some things that I was like, wait a minute, if this thing hunts by sound, how is anything left alive? It would hear heartbeats. It would hear breathing at far lower levels than we do, you know? So yeah, anyway, there were some things that I was a little not buying into with the creature. Creatures, there are more than one.
Yes, there's quite a few. For me, these creatures were terrified looking because whenever they were on the screen, I just like kind of just tried to sink into my seat and like not make any sounds. I really did like the designs. I did not think about heartbeats though.
Good job, Chad. You just brought this film, just lost the whole monocle because of that. Thank you very much.
One monocle.
I mean, like, you think about it, if you're in the forest. and you just ate berries and your stomach is digesting the berries, a thing that hunts by sound is going to hear the acid in your stomach break. Like, it's going to hear it. Mm. It could. I don't know why it wouldn't if that's its entire, like, process of finding food of its own. Anyway.
I think it would have been cool if we would have seen something it couldn't hear. That probably would have, like, helped set a baseline for, like, hey, if it's quieter than this, you're fine.
Yes.
If it's quieter than this, you're fine. We will get those words in an email straight to John Krasinski.
Oh, my gosh.
Again, it's a relatively small gripe, but it is my gripe
True.
With the film.
Yeah, that's cool.
That is one of the normal Chad gripes from a horror film, in all honesty.
The creature design?
No, the more technical aspects of it. Like, that doesn't make sense. Now, why is he doing this when you know?
Yeah, well, for this movie, there's not too much that falls in that category for me of, hey, this doesn't make sense at all. Because that's normally why I avoid horror movies, is that people make, oh, there's a noise in the garage. Let me go check it out instead of bring someone with me who's
Let
like
me
2 feet.
Let me grab a flashlight and go to the garage. Right.
Even though I know there's a
doofus.
Murderer in the neighborhood.
Doofus.
There's not too much of that kind of idiotic logic.
No, there's
movie,
not.
Which I was super happy about.
No, that's really true. Although, I didn't realize this until we had this Demogorgon conversation earlier. Because apparently Chad's
Demogorgon is a character from Stranger Things.
And apparently what's on Chad's shirt right
which
now.
Which is not... what it is, but it's on your shirt. You
true.
Are actually wearing a Stranger Things themed shirt, and you actually do have the Demogorgon represented on it. So,
what's interesting is
let me just turn that right back around on you
thank
again
you.
In an audio podcast that nobody can see. Please take it away, Eddie.
As I was saying, no, it does bear a striking resemblance to the Demogorgon design.
It does
in my mind. Yeah. Aside from, obviously, the Demogorgon has this, like, split-looking head where it has a central part of its face. The Demogorgon...
That's kind of like a Venus flytrap.
Yeah, ultimately.
With a body. The Demogorgon.
Yes.
These are different. These are not... It's like a... I don't know. It's like a... It's sort of like a mix between a small version of the Cloverfield monster with the muscular forearms and the talons and everything. And then, like... An alien from Alien with
an
the teeth.
Alien. It's really cool. I think one of the interesting things about the overall design is the way its head is structured in terms of all these. So the head has like all these little plates and whatnot that fit into different positions to keep that auditory, part of his head hidden and covered. So. That could be part of your answer in terms of why he doesn't hear heartbeats or why he doesn't hear that, because unless he's really listening to it when he opens up his plates in his head and then...
Okay, but it does. There are moments, there are scenes where one of them is in a small space with one of the characters and it is opening part or all of its ear, head, plate feature things and it still doesn't... Anyway... Again, it's a small gripe overall. Also, when the one submerges itself, that freaked me out. I was like, oh, I didn't even think about it doing that. And it goes under the water. And yeah, there are a lot of good payoff moments, especially once things start. Like once the baby starts coming, once she her water breaks and she goes into labor, there are some sort of family dynamic things that lead into that scene. That then, like, this is the ticking time bomb that you've had in mind for the past hour. And so once that happens, I mean, this movie just grabs you and has you for the last 35 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, gunfire and tanks and airplanes and big dramatic whatever. It's intimate fear. It's like small... claustrophobic contained shots and sequences, and you like there were moments with Emily Blunt's character, not joking, I had my left hand covering my mouth and plugging my nose, like, do not do not make a noise. It is right behind you and you know it. Like, I was like grabbing my face and closing my face in support of what she needed to do. Like, that's how much, if you're in it, like, that's how much it gets you.
Yeah. Any last thoughts, Spencer, on the film and maybe any issues that aren't technical, like the one that Chad just crushed in our hearts?
No, he just reminded me of that scene where that thing did go underwater, and I was like,
"Yeah,
oh no, I went
out." Because you're like, I didn't even think about that. Oh no.
And,
oh,
and to where it's even at the time when it goes under the water, it's like, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Gosh. Just all kinds of no.
No.
Every kind of no.
Yeah, these things were pretty scary.
Yeah, but overall, no. I thought this was a fantastic movie. The creatures were cool and very threatening, and a lot of stuff really worked in it well for me, at least.
Yeah, well, there you go. So let's go ahead and go around the table. Does it pass or fail, and how many monocles? Chadley.
I would say it definitely passes for me. I'd give it four monocles.
Chad gives it, wow.
I know.
Four monocles for a most horror
of
film.
This, well, because most of this, the horror angle of it really doesn't start in earnest until it's that 35-minute final climactic sequence. They do a lot of world building, like family world building, that is the kind of storytelling I like more anyway. And they invested heavily in doing that before they got to the real creature feature stuff.
Yeah. Spence, can you top that?
Okay. So, yeah, this movie passes for me. And I've actually been thinking about for a while what I would score this movie. And I think I'm going to go with a 4.25.
Oh, really? A 4.25?
Yeah. Like, because it's really well done. It's really something people should see. But it's not quite a 4.5 for me. But it's still pretty dang awesome. I was really impressed.
You know, I have to say, this is very encouraging to hear both of you actually deem one of these horror films that are out there actually good films. So this is a very momentous moment in our podcast, and I am glad to say I was here for it. It also passes for me, and I'm going to have to give it 4.5 out of 5. It's one of those movies where you're going to want to watch, and you're going to want to watch over and over to kind of catch a lot of little things. And yeah, so I'm actually really excited to find out when it actually comes out on Blu-ray.
My caveat to you is I probably never want to see this movie again.
I would like to watch it again.
I would watch it again. I would be willing to watch it again. I'm not a repeat viewer of horror films.
Yeah. It's funny, this film,
although this isn't primarily, it's not only a horror film. It really isn't.
Right. It's funny, this film actually reminds me of a poem by T.S. Eliot called The Hollow Men, where the last two lines of the poem says, "This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but with a whisper." And so it's really unique in how it relates to this. And so if you get a chance, check out this film. It's already in theaters, so go out there, put your money to it, and let us know what you think. Drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. We want to hear your thoughts. Did you like it? Did you not? And should Chad wear more Demogorgon shirts? Because he's looking good in the one he's wearing right now.
Wow, it's not even a Demogorgon shirt, but okay.
It really isn't.
Let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. We got Blumhouse's Truth or Dare, which looks ridiculous.
Talk about your like run-of-the-mill gore fest movies.
Okay, yeah. There.
This is that kind of movie.
I don't want to see Blumhouse become one of those types of studios. It's like two doors down from it becoming Asylum, and it's because it's putting out dribble like this. So I'm a little worried.
Yeah.
Well, it's part of their business strategy
to become B movie status producer. Or
no, make
studios?
Super cheap movies, and then you know the ones that do well. The ones that don't.
True.
I don't believe that.
The man has points.
Also coming out this week is Rampage, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson. So get to your local theaters, get to watching some movies, and if you can, check out A Quiet Place. This was a great conversation here, and if you're interested, check out our bonus episode on Extra Credit as we talk about one of the unique aspects of going to go see this movie, and why you might want to really rethink about where you go, which theater you
go to. Consider who's in the room with you.
Yes. So, if you want to check that out, check out our latest episode on Extra Credit. So, but this is a great episode, guys. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.